Session number 6840, reel 6.
The second time round working on Singapore docks, we had some strange encounters. One of the jobs we had was to load a German mother ship to feed the submarine crews that had been harboured in Singapore. How they managed to elude the blockade and get as far as Singapore, I'll never know. But the Germans themselves were very kind to us. Perhaps it was because we were white-skinned and they were amongst coloured people all the time. One of the rough jobs we had was loading drums of carbide. The trouble is, the heat in the holds of the ships in Singapore were absolutely terrific. The sweat literally just run from us like water, and you're encountering burst drums of carbide, and the powder settling on the sweat. We were getting terrific burns. That every so often we had to come out the hold and hose ourselves down from the sides of the ship. And that, of course, caused great humour to both the odd Italian and Germans that were moving about the docks, their unrest from the submarines. I recall that some of the Germans once were scoffing at us, having to be in the nude, getting washed on the quay side. And a chap called Malcolm Dinning, who before the war had worked in Germany and could speak fluent German, he made a prophecy that someday they may be in the same condition as us. And strange to relate, of course, his prophecy came true, because after VE Day, the Germans themselves, from what I understand, became interned and were prisoners. How they were treated, I have no knowledge, but I'm certain that what I was told about them becoming prisoners is the truth. One of the worst jobs, I suppose, we had for danger was loading coal onto the boats. We had the job of trimming the coal after the coal grab had dropped approximately 50 hundredweight at a time into the hold of the ship. So we in turn used to have to get into the middle and trim it onto the sides to keep an even keel. And I recall that one of the cables of the coal grab snapped, and a chap called Doug Crane was caught in a shower of coal. Of course, we had panic stations digging him out, and we dug him out, but he'll bear scars to this day, because I understand that once you've been cut with coal, you have blue scars, and he had quite a number of blue scars on his shoulders, tops of his arms, and some on his face and forehead. We were only there a short while, because in February of 45, we were told we were going to be shipped to Japan. And the boat we boarded was a Dutch coaster called the Jer Strommer. It had been built approximately 1908 at North Shields, Newcastle area of England. There was a complement of about 1,800 men on this tiny coaster with a cargo of tin ingots, latex and some ammonol, which I understand was a type of explosive. And it was a hell ship, you can believe me. It was impossible but to get onto the deck only at rare occasions. And when you went to go to the toilet, if that's the right term, you had to climb out the ship's side into a box that was slung over the side and it had the central plank knocked out. And I remember that the thing slipped and the chap called Sandy Gilholm was the first surf rider I ever seen in the Singapore area. One of the chaps I was friendly with, a lad called Rutherford, nicknamed Snakey Rutherford, he was a Jap tow man, and therefore he always had surplus food that the Japanese had been left over. So of course, naturally, you were friendly with him, but to be certain of having extra rations. So he had more of an eyewitness account of when our convoy was attacked than any other person, I think. And I understand that of the 7 boats that was in the original convoy, ours was the only boat to survive. So we evidently must have made a heading for the nearest land, which, as it turned out, we didn't know, was approaching the river on which Saigon stood. All we seen was on these low little islands, or even in the sea as we thought, the river itself, was wrecks of planes and ships had been sunk, and we thought there must have been a rare old battle going on. Of course, we were wiser later when we realised what had happened. The Americans had attacked to make certain there was no reinforcements could be shipped to the Philippines when they'd invaded the Philippines. But as we were approaching land, we could see land on either side. All of a sudden, air raid sirens went. We thought, oh God, it looks as though we're going to be attacked now by planes. But it transpired that we found out later that the docks in Saigon had been subdivided, one part for the Japanese and the other part for the Vichy French. And Japanese adhered to Tokyo time, while the Vichy French still kept Greenwich Mean Time, hence the discrepancy in time. And the air raid sirens was used to alert people to adjust the watches to one time or the other. We worked on the docks in Saigon, and I was really amazed to see how many fair-headed children there was, but had to be straight back with no bump of knowledge, which was typical of an Annamese. So that must be an indication of French colonialism. A further job we had was working on Saigon Aerodrome, extending the runways, and a chap called Bernard Boyle and I used to work filling the tankers, or stretchers as we called them, and the Annamese kiddies were carrying them away. And the only two words that I can know in Annamese is Makmuk and Kup Chai. I don't know whether I was Makmuk and he was Kup Chai. That doesn't matter. But the meaning is, I understand, it means thank you very much. So the Annamese kiddies used to grin like billy-o, put the thumbs up and say Makmuk Kup Chai. Another job we had, I think it was called task number 3. Some of the cases we had to do was to tie these cases with rice straw, and the knotting that was taught to us by the Japanese was pretty intricate. Perhaps I was a bit stupid, but I oftentimes did not get the hang of it, and I got a few whacks. A chap called Doug Cotton was on that particular task, and he recalls me, but I don't internally call him, but he's jogged my memory about this particular incident. In Saigon camp itself, I recall, there were some really nasty characters of the guards. One was called The Face. He had a childish face, but of course baby face was too obvious, so he just was called The Face. Another chap was called Rubber Lips. He was a giant of a man. He must have been 6'2" at least, and shoulders like a barn door. And he frequently used to go to the cookhouse and demand an omelette of whatever eggs had been brought in by the Chinese contractors. So one day, some enterprising being got all of us chaff that had dysentery, collected his stool and put the stool into the omelette, and of course Rubber Lips duly scoffed the omelette and was seized ill with dysentery. But unfortunately, from what I understand, after leaving the camp he did recover. Worse luck. There was a Japanese sergeant who had a lover, and evidently this other chap escaped over the wire, and from all accounts he made his way back to China. But anyway, this sergeant, he really took it to heart the way this chap had disappeared, and he was nicknamed Escape Me Never. And I understand that he later committed suicide. That would be one Jap less than goodness. Sometimes at night we used to go outside the camp perimeter and start to dig trenches, supposedly for air raid shelters. And I recall standing in what I thought was a pool of water in the moonlight, and I thought, this is strange, because the ground itself was just like iron. And I put my finger down and touched this pool of water, as I thought, tested my finger, and I realised it was salty, that what had happened, I cut the end off my big toe with a chunkle, and what I was doing was standing into a pool of blood. How, I don't know, but fortunately, my toe's healed up, but it is a little bit kinky. It's not like a normal big toe should be. I recall in Saigon, we had a concert, and there was a certain Major Seakin of the Cambridge Regiment. He had retained his watch, and it was hung up in the room where we all slept, so we could keep a check on the time. For what reason, I don't know. But this particular concert, the comedian walked on the stage, put his hand to his eyes, and as he was walking along, he was saying, "Seeking, seeking, seeking. Looking, looking, looking. Time marches on." Which was the signature of Pathy Movietone when we were back in England, with the newsreels. I don't know if the watch ever turned up again, but it was a very subtle play on the man's name, Major Seakin. One particular morning, we were lined up for work, and we invariably used to go in batches of 50. The Japanese, they could count in fives, that was the limit of their ability. And this particular party of 50, they called for a hansho, which was the equivalent of like a leader, and nobody was volunteering. So invariably, they used to pick on the first man, and he was automatically a hansho. So this particular day, I volunteered to be the hansho. And after organising the party, I asked the Jap if two men could go back to the cookhouse for tea. And while they were away, he started to indicate to me Burma and the Philippines, and that the British were coming through Burma and the Americans were in the Philippines. And if they start to converge either on Indochina, or else if they try to send an invasion force onto Japan, all Japanese had to execute all prisoners they had in their possessions. The indication, as far as our camp was concerned, was the air raid sirens was to go as though there was going to be an actual air raid. And as we trooped out the camp to go into these air raid shelters, we had to be machine gunned down. But he indicated to me that if I could go stay into the camp and knock the bunghole out of the huge stone troughs which were used for us to be bathing in, but had originally been for horses because it had been a French cavalry barracks and Le Dogo, when the commotion was ended, he'd come to me and in turn take me to Cholon, which was a part of the Chinese quarter of Saigon, and hopefully we'd both survive, and I'd indicate that he'd saved my life, and therefore he in turn wouldn't be executed as a criminal. Going back to camp, I reported this to one of the officers, and whether he believed me or not, I don't know, but I said to him, would he in turn say I was on the first draft out of Saigon, which he duly did. There was a party of 50. There was 25 Dutchmen and 25 British, and we entrained and went to a place called Da Nang. In Da Nang, we worked building small jetties so that lighters could be brought up and collect or be loaded with ammunition for larger boats for the Japanese, I presume, so they could try and reinforce the Philippines. We were only there a short while, and we moved down from Da Nang to a place called Nha Trang. Now, Nha Trang was a beautiful place to look at. It had waving palms, silver sands, and the sea itself was as clear as crystal. You could literally see fish swimming at least 100 metres away. It was just what you'd imagine a travel brochure should be like. We'd only been in Da Nang a few days, when a French priest came cycling along, and he was chanting, "C'est la guerre finie." So I presume it must have been some part of June, because that was indicating VE, the victory in Europe, which was a great boost to our morale. At Nha Trang, the Sergeant Major, Japanese, was about the only being that was a Japanese in the camp, and he could speak jolly good English. The rest of the camp guards were all Koreans, and he questioned us as to how we'd been set in previous camps, and we told him about rubber lips and about the hardships of the railway, so he forbade the Koreans to approach us unless he was around. So what came about was the Korean quartermaster used to come at night when it was dark and call across to us and say the particular job that we had to go on to the next day had a cash valuation of a certain amount of pesetas, and in turn in the local market pork was such and such a price catty and vegetables were such and such a price, and what did we want with our money that had been allocated for these particular jobs. At Nha Trang, you'd hardly believe this, but it's perfectly true. We had flush toilets, we had showers, and we had mosquito nets, and even the bottom of the mosquito nets still retained the blue cotton, which in other places, if there had been mosquito nets, the blue cotton was invariably cut off so we could make G-strings for ourselves. The war must have been over approximately a fortnight before we knew. I know that must have been an approximation after the capitulation of Japan, but about a week at least, we used to go out the camp perimeter and just sit outside on the sands, doing no work whatsoever, then just coming back to the camp. Finally, the Japanese Sergeant Major announced that the war between his fatherland and our countries was over, and he in turn was going to allow French civilians to come into the camp, which he did do so, and they arrived with rickshaws full of wines and food, and of course, naturally, certain parties did abuse the fact of the drink, and being worse for wear, he turfed out the French civilians, but he promised that they'd be re-entered again the next day, but it'd be organised and we'd have a party. And in turn, after having a few drinks, the Sergeant Major himself would insist on singing La Ploma. After singing the same song for about four times, somebody who was also inebriated took off a wooden clog and clonked him over the head, and he just keeled over. And I thought, oh, this is the end. We're certain to be shot now for attacking the Sergeant Major. But lo and behold, nothing at all happened. There was a certain lady called Lynette Turon. She had originally lived in the Rue Quesnay in Hanoi, Tonkin, North Indochina, and she brought us thousands and thousands of pesetas and said if we wanted more, we could have them. Anyway, the number that she brought in was divided among us, and we thought the valuation of these would be the same as the Thai banana dollars, as we termed them, because the banana dollars used to be issued to the workers on the Thai-Burma railway. The Japanese used to bring up a little PU truck with a tiny printing press in the back and print off the money and pay the men as they finished work. So we in turn thought, well, these are of no value. So we used them as toilet paper, which of course was a luxury after 3.5 years of using leaves of any kind or whatever you could do using water to clean yourself, that we thought this was a great treat using paper. That we know to our own consternation the valuation of these bits of paper money. We still, of course, naturally had a major part of our diet as rice, and there were three paratroops came into our camp. I remember one had a green cockade in his belly. What regiment he was, I don't know, but the rice ration had came up, and we were having the boiled rice and also the burnt rice which came from the sides of the quarry. And when he seen the rice being dished out, and pieces of burnt rice too, he said, where's the bread? And we said, bread? You must be joking. We haven't tasted or seen bread for 3.5 years. And quite innocently, he turned around and said, well, how have you existed? Well, the obvious answer to that was, we were there as living proof that you can exist without bread, even for that long period of time. While we were waiting for transportation from Nha Trang down to Saigon to be congregated with the rest of the peoples of the Indochina area, we were ordered at night to go on a night guard, a Japanese named Fushin Ban. There was two prisoners of war was going around with one Japanese soldier guarding the camp. I think the idea was the Japanese was afraid of either the Viet Cong or the Viet Nim attacking the camp once the war was over, and they must have felt safe, the fact that there was two white-skinned persons patrolling along with one Japanese soldier. But of course, fortunately, there was no incidents to report at that time. En route from Nha Trang down to Saigon, the train itself was ambushed at a place called Myong Man. I presume it was a Viet Cong that had opened fire, seen fair-skinned men, thinking it was perhaps French troops. But fortunate for us, having the Jap guards with us, the Jap guards opened fire, and we duly got back to Saigon safely. But what a scare it was. We were all laid down as flat as we could be in the trucks, and let the Japanese do what fighting was to be done, while we just said our prayers. when we arrived in Saigon, we found the Americans had already had provisions and that brought in, and they were handsomely dressed in like silk, superfine uniforms. We were still wandering around in our old G-strings and bits and pieces we could salvage. Therefore, when the French people were coming into the camp, we were hiding round corners, because Saigon is known as the Paris of the East, that some of the women, both French and Anglo-French, were both beautiful and wonderfully dressed too. I can recall that we had a film show one night, and it was called La Beau Bonne Soldate. It was spoken, I think, in French, but it had subtitles in Annamese and also in English. That's the only recollection I can ever have of seeing a film show while I was a prisoner of war. We were still on a diet of rice, even in Saigon, and I can recall one particular morning, a chap called Albert Chandler was on rice orderly, and when he was coming along from the cookhouse with the 4-gallon cans of pap rice, one of the enterprising chaps, a lad called Alan Oxley, shouted to him, "Rub it in your hair." So what he promptly done was, he got each of the 2 4-gallon tins of pap rice and tipped them over him and said, "Try rubbing your hair, mate, and see how you like it." We went along to Saigon airport so that we could be flown out to Burma or India, and while we were there, we were handed queue forms for to state any atrocities we'd witnessed. And before the flight was due that I was to go out on, it came over the tannoy, well, Corporal Barwick remained behind and reported to the orderly room as he wanted to be retained for to give evidence at any war criminal tribunal there may be. And my hat sunk in my boots. I thought surely there can only be one Corporal Barwick. But fortunately, further announcements came asking for a Corporal Barwick of the Cambridge Regiment. So, of course, I naturally boarded the DAC and flew out from Saigon. We touched down at Bangkok for refueling, and from Bangkok we went on to Rangoon. At that point in time, I was yellow, or even more yellow than the Japs, with jaundice. So while I was in the tented hospital in Rangoon, or just outside of Rangoon to be more precise, I was put on a diet of boiled rice and boiled tomatoes. If you can imagine anything more insipid than that, I'd eat my hat, whereas some of the other lads was woofing into the American care rations, and I was either green with envy or I was yellow with jaundice, which colour I can't decide. We boarded a Red Cross hospital boat from Rangoon to sail to Calcutta, and at the dockside at Calcutta there was a British Marine band playing, and I said to the chaps who stood beside me on the rails, "If these play Rule Britannia, Britons never shall be slaves, I'm going to jump over." Fortunately for me, they restrained me as me being a non-swimmer, because lo and behold, that was a tune that they stuck up. I'm sure it was intended with the best will in the world, but to us it was a dire insult. From the dock at Calcutta, we were taken to a place called Ranchi. I suppose it was a hill station for convalescents. But of course, I was yellow with jaundice and I was on medication. And a Polish doctor asked if anybody was willing to volunteer to fly home. And I was one of the people that volunteered to fly home. So perhaps other persons may have went down to Calcutta for transshipping home, but I remained there a short time longer. And the Swiss Red Cross came into this camp and had Swiss wristwatches and fountain pens, etc., to be sold. And I fancied a particular watch. And when I inquired, the price was £2.10. And I asked for an advance of pay from the quartermaster sergeant, and he informed me that there'd be no pay issued until we got back to England to find out the extent of our credits. And I can recall an American who was in the same camp. He said to us just hours previous, "Say, guy, when you get back to England, You'll have to have a stepladder to get over that pile of dollars, which is credit to you. And yet, in turn, we weren't allowed even to have £2, £10 to buy Swiss wristwatches through the Red Cross itself, so there's no contract. It was posted in the barrack room at Ranchi, if we had any foreign money, the equivalent of English money was such that we could exchange it into English money. And I remember the French piastre was equivalent to about 1 4, and we in turn had utilised all our piastres to be used as toilet paper. Boy, was I green with envy once again. We went to a place called Bakakama to get onto the plane to fly home, as we thought, and there were American B-27s, and we were issued with either 6 or 8 blankets, and we sat on wooden benches in the bomb bays, wrapped in the blankets because of the extreme cold. And the first stop, if I recall, was Dum Dum in India, and from Dum Dum we went to a place called Morapur, which I think is the name of the airport, at Karachi. From Morapur we arrived at Tel Aviv, and there we would be staying for a few days. I don't know if it was to wait for another plane to come and take us away or for what reason, but I remember we understood we were going to stay for a few days. But when we went on the apron at Tel Aviv to fly back to England, there was a York Avro plane, was just quite near us, and the Jewish terrorists, I think it was the Aragon Vealiumi, must have put a time bomb on, because this plane blew up, and there was panic stations on the airfield itself, and we moved back to our barracks, and we stayed approximately 2 weeks in Tel Aviv, waiting for clearance for to get another plane to fly home. So in that 2 weeks, we utilised it to do certain tours. We went to Jerusalem and seen the Wailing Wall and different parts like Mount Gethsemane and the Mount of Olives and the 12 stations of the cross. I had my photograph taken with another group of FIPOWs and an interpreter just outside the Mosque of Omar in Jerusalem. I understand that is about the second or the third most holy place in the Arab world, so I have proof of my stay in Jerusalem. Reverting back to Tel Aviv, I can recall it's like a seaside resort, and there's a photographer there, just like we find photographers in England at these seaside resorts, and there's a little Jewish child, he's very, very fair-skinned and fair curly hair, and I had my photograph taken with him. And when I arrived back in England and the sister-in-law seen it, she said, "It just shows that your sins have caught up with you. You must have called back over, and this is what happened as you were flying out." We also went along to Bethlehem on a trip, and I remember it was a long and tedious journey, but it was something worthwhile, because it's something that will never happen again in my lifetime. As for one thing, I'd never have the inclination, and secondly, I don't suppose I'd ever have the cash to undertake such a journey. We flew out from Tel Aviv eventually, and we landed at a place called Castel Bonito in Tripolitania, and from there we flew on and arrived at Manchester in England, of course showered with gifts once we arrived, but all too soon this part of the journey was over. We boarded trains and of course arrived duly back at home in Middlesbrough, where I was greeted on the railway station like a conquering hero. When it came to us having our medical, we went down to Wilson Street above, and the place above Stewart's store was the medical centre, and when I went in the doctor looked at me and he asked what complaints I'd had. And I said the usual things like beriberi, dysentery, pellagra, jungle ulcers, and he was reaching out for a form, and I said to him, "If you can put that away, I've nothing at all to do with the forces. In theory, I went for 6 months, and I've done practically 7 years, so as far as the army's concerned, him and I are part of company. I wouldn't even join 2 pieces of string, never mind having any further connections with the army. So henceforth, of course, I've never had a pension, and touching wood, I've always enjoyed good health, I've never had occasion to regret the statement I made to this particular doctor, whoever he was.